This is Anya Leonard, the co-founder of Classical Wisdom, a website dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds.
This month I'm speaking with Nicholas Pappas, professor of philosophy and executive officer of the philosophy program at the City University of New York Graduate Center. He's an expert in Plato and author of several books, including Plato's Exceptional City, Love and Philosopher, Politics and Philosophy in Plato's Menexenus, as well as the Routledge Guidebook to Plato's Republic. We discuss how we can understand ancient art and theater, what role psychology plays in its understanding, as well as the goal of Plato's Republic.
And I think the best place to begin is with aesthetics. So basically, you have written quite a lot about aesthetics. And perhaps a nice place to start would to be describe how poetry and the arts were sort of understood in the ancient world, and in what ways are they sort of different from our modern era?
Yeah, thank you. And first of all, let me just thank you for this kind invitation and for this opportunity to chat. I've been thinking how best to begin, because of course you identify exactly the issue when we're talking about something like art forms from the ancient world. The issue is how to keep in mind both the appropriate similarities and the appropriate differences. We don't want to be anachronistic and imagine that we just came across Oedipus Rex last week. It could have been written last week, but we also don't want to lock classical writings away in some kind of vault and imagine them as completely disconnected from us. Okay, so having said that, now let me just say how I came to do so much about ancient aesthetics. Fair question. I actually started my philosophizing worrying about issues in modern aesthetics, mostly having to do with the literary arts. What is an interpretation? What is a metaphor? I was studying with Stanley Cavell, and I was brought through him to questions of literature, like a type of question about literature that really engaged him, especially in connection with Shakespearean tragedy, was how a literary work addressed a philosophical problem like the problem of knowledge. Now, Cavell's questions were always very much rooted in modernity and modernism. And I still think they're very important approaches to modern phenomena. But by that time, I was trying to coordinate what he said with other issues I was thinking about with antiquity, like what was going on with problems of knowledge in ancient tragedy. You know, there's one way in which Hamlet doesn't know what's going to happen to Claudius after Claudius dies. Lear doesn't know whether his children love him. Now in Sophocles, both Electra in her play and Oedipus in the play named after him, they're both denied knowledge, but in a different way. And the audience is watching them knowing something that they respectively fail to know. That's not exactly the problem we have with Hamlet. When Hamlet wonders, you know, is Claudius possibly going to go to heaven? And then what's the point of my killing him? Well, it's not as though we in the audience know, you know, surprise, Claudius isn't going, right? We don't have that knowledge. So it's just a different orientation toward knowledge, how human beings relate to knowledge, and how human beings can assess one another's knowledge. So that's just one example of what you and I were just talking about, the overlap and yet the difference, and how we try to.
I feel like there are a lot of modern comparisons in which the audience does know exactly what's going to happen, as long as it's a story that is so ingrained in our culture. And I mean, maybe a cheesy but very modern example would be like origin stories of Batman or something like that, or the Joker or something. You watch the Joker and you're like, yeah, I know what's going to happen, because these stories are so familiar. And so for the ancient audience, they would have known Oedipus's story so well.
That's true. Oh, we could really go into that. Do you like whether the Joker is a tragedy? Aristotle would have problems there, although it's certainly enough of a tragedy for Plato to object to it. But I love that example. No cheese in that example at all, from what I can see.
I don't know, maybe superheroes might be.
And superhero, I mean, the very interest in superheroes itself feels to me like some kind of hope for a classical literature. You know what I mean? It never works. I always think that I'm just denying myself these superhero movies. And I was in Taiwan all by myself, and it was one of those sudden shifts of night and day. So I knew I wasn't going to sleep. And I found that Thor was playing on TV. So I thought, what a perfect time to just watch Thor. And I hate to say this, I couldn't tolerate it. I really thought it was this guilty pleasure. And in fact, it wasn't. That wasn't where my guilty pleasures lay. But still, this thought that you're gonna like Thor or Captain America. See, to my mind, that's the impulse that also pulls us to ancient mythology. You know, or rather, it's the desire for mythology that makes us still enjoy Thor and Captain America. But I wanted to answer your question. About points of contact and points of difference. And one thing I would start with there, when you talk whether about tragedy or the visual arts, there are two differences I would want to talk to. One of them is well known and talked about a lot. And the other one is also well known and in my experience, not talked about very much at all. So let me start there. And that is the rarity of people's exposure to the arts in the ancient world. If you lived in ancient Athens, so we're not even imagining you in a little small town in antiquity, but if you were in classical Athens, you know, you'd see some sculptures in the heart of town, assuming that you had reason to go to the heart of town. Farmers pretty much stayed on their land unless they came in for the assembly. Music, well, you might hear music at a dinner party or if someone were singing or at a special festival. Drama, you'd see at its peak when they had the two dramatic festivals. You might be in for 6 days of theatrical performances in a year. Okay, so when someone like Plato sounds terrified about the effect of going to the theater, you have to remember he's imagining the response someone is going to have to seeing a handful of plays in a year. And today, when we worry about, let's say, violence on television, you know, you may have heard these statistics. A child has seen 8,000 murders on TV by the time they finish elementary school. By the time you're 18, you have seen 200,000 violent acts on TV. Right. It's a lot. That's not the, you know, that's the wrong time for someone to say, well, you have to put it in context. It's not in context. But when you assess that, you think, well, if I don't know how many violent acts would be the right number to see by the time you finish high school. It's certainly not 200,000, but we talk about it as if we were talking about cholesterol in the food, you know, or fats, right? But Plato is talking about something quite different. And when we identify the plays that he could see with the plays that we can see, we have to take note of this difference. He's talking about some corrupting effect that they have where you could be ruined by seeing a few. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not worried that you're going to go in and see Oedipus day after day and, you know, and have this effect on your psyche. You see, it's more like pardon the comparison, it's more like inhaling the virus than like eating fatty foods.
So, yeah, that's amazing to think that, I guess when you do think about it, you see Oedipus Rex once, like, you're not going to forget it. I mean, ever.
That's
it's
right.
Not like one that you watch and you're like, what did I watch last night? You know, that doesn't happen.
I just realized I saw this before. Wait a minute.
Yeah. Oh, wait. He sleeps with his mother. That's what happens. Oh, I forget. Yeah.
That's right. You're trying to guess it like it's an episode of Murder, She Wrote. You know, wait a minute. Well, we're going to figure out who got Laios. So, of course, Aristotle defends the mimetic presentation, whether of poetry or visual art. Plato is suspicious of them. But in both cases, they're responding to something that was really quite rare in experience. Mm-hmm. You know, and I do think that's one difference to keep in mind. The other difference, the one I said that is talked about a lot, so I don't need to say too much, is the religious function. I mean, as you know, tragedies were related to the worship of Dionysus. It was a tragic festival, part of the celebration of Dionysus. In terms of visual arts, well, take sculptural forms. Sure, by the time we get to the classical era, we have these statues that we can look at and say, well, that looks so realistic, especially when it's a man, a young adult or adult man, and often represented naked. Women were not in that period. You know, I mean, after all, we know what human beings look like. We say, wow, that really looks like a human being. So in that sense, by the way, one way in which visual art can connect us with other times is to the extent that it depicts the human form, right? Because human beings biologically haven't changed that much. But then you have this whole other tradition of sculpture. A tombstone with a figure on it was not just a representation, but it was thought to make communication possible with the shade of the person in the underworld. On the island of Samos, a plank of wood washed ashore, and it was treated as a representation of the goddess Hera, Samos, of course, being the island of Hera. Not that it looked like her. I don't know. I suppose it had to be minimally like human proportions. A plank like that, but you would have, or you would have little wax figures that were treated as representations either of the gods. You pray to these figures to make contact with the gods, or you might make contact with a lost family member or spouse in that way. And this has nothing to do with the mimetic function of statuary, something that we immediately grasp. And here's the point I wanted to make, not just that the ancient Greeks had these religious and superstitious uses of sculpture. They considered that the known quantity. Like, well, so even Plato, you know, he has his character say, well, sure, ghosts hang around the tombs, you know, for some days after the person dies. Sure, we pray to the little votive images we have at home in order to connect with the gods. He doesn't have any problem with thinking of sculpture that way, you know, but, you know, God help you if you wanted to make a representational one that looked like someone else, that runs into problems. Whereas for us, it's the opposite. It makes total sense if you've got a visual art that looks like the thing it represents. Once you start imagining that it connects you with unseen forces, that would need to be understood.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting on several different historical points I'm kind of putting together in my head here. But one, I mean, the concept of imbuing a statue with sort of more life or meaning seems to be like a common trait that you have in pre-literate societies, like the totem. You know, you see that originals or everywhere in Southeast Asia and in the Amazon, that's kind of like a common thing. And then at the same time, you think of the idea that representing a person directly seems to be more in keeping with, say, the Judeo-Christian Abrahamic religions, where you are afraid of, you know, the representation of a human, and that leads to iconoclasm. So it's weird that you would have these sort of two different trends that would happen sort of at the same time in Greece, when they seem to be happening at completely other time periods and places elsewhere.
Ah, that's very interesting. Yes. And, oh gosh, well, I have to say the same thing to you. There are some like three great tangents we could go off to what you said. One of them, I would say, is Clement of Alexandria. I mean, he's writing before Christianity has been officially tolerated in the empire, but as it's growing, as it's institutionalized, and he's writing to try to win the Greeks over from their primitive polytheistic religion. Okay. But at the same time, Clement knows that there were some smart philosophers, and he tries to incorporate them. He's especially fond of Plato. So Clement, then he's trying to do something contradictory. And I think you put your finger on why it's contradictory. He uses Plato's arguments against resemblance, representation in statuary, but he associates the resemblance with the human impulse to pray to statues, even though that was not historically what was going on. It was really the non-iconic representations that were the more, that were treated as objects of worship. So Clement tries to run it all together and condemn ancient Greek art and ancient Greek religion using Plato where he can, even though Plato's got a different purpose in mind, different agenda. Yeah,
you can see how that it becomes problematic pretty quickly. But why did exactly Plato not like the representation of persons? I mean, I understand for iconoclasm that it's a religious element. Was it the same?
Yeah. No. Well, maybe in the back of his mind, part of his motive is that he sees something that had been functioning perfectly well in a religion being taken over and made into this more secular art form. This is speculation because we don't get very much along these lines in Plato. I mean, if you'll, the modern analogy that leaps to my mind is that I'm thinking of it because I saw the movie about Ray Charles, you know, and Ray Charles used musical forms and chord progressions that had been associated with gospel music and made them into this very exciting popular music. All right, so you can imagine a devotee of gospel music thinking that, you know, we can't have that.
It's making the sacred into the profane.
That's right, exactly. Now, so I do think there's an element of that in Plato, but not highly articulated. When it comes to statuary, it's interesting because sometimes he, you know, that's never his main target when he's worried about the arts. And sometimes Plato talks about visual representations in general as if they were just fine. People don't notice, for example, in the Republic, after condemning a lot of drama, he turns around and says, well, we have to expose young people to the right kind of visual representations and inspire them to the right actions. But when he does go after visual art, it's interesting. It's not just that it looks like something else. It's the way that it's pandering to your vision. I'll give you one example. suppose, you know, you see a tree reflected in a pond. That's a natural made representation. Plato says in his dialogue, The Sophist, the gods make representations like that. No problem there. But suppose you have a large statue, and it's so large that when we stand at the foot of the statue and we look up, the head and the shoulders look too small, right? We get the proportions wrong because of perspective.
Hence, Michelangelo's David has a huge head, right?
Exactly. And from what we're told, I don't know whether this is true, even at an earlier age when the statues were big enough, sculptors used to do that. So the big statue of Athena in the Parthenon, apparently, big head. Now, what's interesting about that is, Plato's argument is, you see what's going on there. The artist has lost all interest in what something actually is like and is only focusing on getting the look of it right to you. And I think that's one big part of Plato's worry about the representational arts, that they're just playing to the manipulation of images, what we would call the simulacrum, and not trying to make the appearance be something that could lead us to actual information about the thing.
That's so fascinating, because like nowadays, obviously, it's a very popular trend to have something be like a cool illusion, or, you know, a mural that you look at it from a different way, or sculpture. There's a famous sculpture down here in Buenos Aires that's supposed to like represent the missing people during the military junta. And it's like, you turn it in one way and you see all these people, and then you walk around the other way and it's just a mess of metal or something. And that's like a trend, it's a fashion. That's like kind of what makes it art. So it's amazing to think that Plato would have been like, that's untrue, that's falsehood.
Yeah, and let's take it a step further. So you're looking at a drawing of a table. So forget a sculpture now for a minute, a drawing or a painting of a table. And of course you see one side of it, because that's what paintings are. Now, you're curious, you think, what would the other side of that table look like? So you turn the painting over, and of course you don't see the other side of the table. Well, of course the answer is, don't be an idiot. Once you learn how to look at a painting, you know that the other side of the painting is not going to show you the other side of the table. And at this point, I believe Plato would say, that's not being an idiot. What's really perverse and corrupt about learning to appreciate art is knowing that your eyes are not going to lead you to the true information about this table, right? That's what's weird. You know, here's this nice, this well-intentioned child seeking to learn the table. And we say, oh, ha, this is art. That means you can't find out about the table by looking at it. And so by making the child not more primitive, but more sophisticated about art, we thereby make them more perverse about their own act of seeing. I think that's what really bugs Plato.
So would Plato think about Picasso's cubism? Would he been like, yes, finally, somebody's trying to like get a picture, like, bravo. And yet, ironically, you know, cubism makes it look almost unrecognizable sometimes, even though he's trying to show all the sides at the same time.
Sorry here. I've actually thought about this question and I can't come to a decision. I mean, there is a part of me that agrees that he'd say, okay, well, cubism at least confronts us with the reality of what looking at an object is like. On the other hand, you know, so I'm just giving you what I'm showing you why I don't have an answer. Yeah. on the other hand, he might say, the problem is whenever we appeal as artists to just the act of looking, we make people enjoy looking without learning more than they enjoy looking and therefore learning. And that's what's wrong with art. When you like the appearance, without any interest in the reality.
Yeah. There's a lot to ponder on that one.
Yeah, people have been chewing that over.
Now, okay, so maybe we should use this as a moment to move forward, because I think this kind of leads into the next point, is psychology. Because this is something else you sort of focus on, and we are sort of already talking about art and reality and perception. So maybe moving on, what is sort of the intersection between art and psychology? Like, how do those interact?
Oh, yeah. That's very interesting. And again, and you're quite right. You know, one of the things that kept me attached to Plato from one of the first few times that I read him was his psychological insight. I'm not going to pretend that Plato had a theory the way a modern psychologist has a theory. You know, I certainly wouldn't claim that he went around and conducted studies or, you know, ran experiments. He was an armchair psychologist. I would say he was an unusually perceptive observer of those around him and of the peculiarities of personality. I will give him that. But as I said, I'm not pretending that he's got a scientific theory. And one of the things he figures out is that there are irrational motivations. You know, and the Republic in particular strikes me as very alert to the nature of inner conflict, you know, and not just that you want to do something and you're also torn, you want not to do it, but there are different kinds of inner conflict. I think that's just a brilliant insight. There's one time, you might say, when you're thirsty, but you know that the water is poisonous, so you don't drink it. So that's your thirst being fought against by your reason. And then there's another time when you might get angry and you have this impulse to, you know, to berate someone, but you also think, you know, this is not the right time to express anger. And those are different conflicts. Okay. So I think it's very insightful of Plato to see that. And so, as you know, he works out a fairly sophisticated tripartite psychology of the human soul. Okay. Now, in Book 10 of the Republic, there's this interesting line. They had talked about poetry, about drama in particular, what Socrates calls mimesis, which can be translated, as you know, imitation, emulation, representation. And he has already banned poetic mimesis from the good city. And then he comes back to it and he says, Socrates says to Glaucon, now that we've seen what the soul is like, now we've seen that the types of souls there can be, we've got another reason to ban mimetic poetry. So he explicitly says, we're going to tie the psychological theory together with the criticism of poetry. And you might say, well, it stands to reason, not so much with sculpture, but when you're seeing a tragedy, you're seeing people worked up in the grip of strong emotions, some, you know, with you might say wholesome emotions, others with more perverse emotions. You think, wow, if you've got a psychological theory, it surely can explain what's going on here. And then this ambiguity, as I see it, by the way, not everybody is going to agree with what I'm saying here, just so you know.
Those are the best ideas. I got
it. Okay. Okay, good. Just a consumer warning. Okay. Where do you apply the psychological theory to this phenomenon, this fascinating, complex phenomenon of tragedy? Okay. Is your theory going to explain what's going on in the characters? Is it going to explain what's going on in the author? Is it going to explain what's going on in the audience? Now, what I find interesting is that when you really try to think clearly about what Socrates says in Book 10 of the Republic, sometimes he's pushing in one direction, sometimes in another. You know, you're saying, so where's the psychological problem in tragedy? Does, you know, and he'll talk about the nature of the tragic poet, but then he'll talk about the characters in the tragedy, and then he'll talk about the members of the audience. Now, I'll tell you why I find this particular intersection or the ambiguity of the application especially interesting. So in the 20th century, and people like to point out that psychoanalysis emerged at roughly the same time as film. You know, they're the same age. They're if not siblings.
Funnily, we're both talking from like capital cities of psychoanalysts. Like Buenos Aires actually has the highest rate of psychoanalysts per capita. There, everybody has a therapist. So this is like every single person starts off a sentence with, you know, my therapist said.
Oh, wow. And of course, you're aware that New York City has a few analysts.
Just a few.
I really considered it as like a little personal milestone. One day I was having a conversation with a psychoanalyst friend. She wanted to talk about a dream that she had had. and then she said, and let's identify the wish element in this dream. And I thought, wow, you know, not just talking to an analyst about a dream, but talking to the analyst about their own dream. Right. Now I'm really living in New York.
You made it. Yeah. You're now officially a New Yorker.
That's right. Okay. So, well, it's interesting because from a pretty early point in psychoanalysis, and you see some of this in Freud too, people try to apply psychoanalysis to literary works. You know, and Freud does a few examples. He's appropriately cautious about what he can and cannot say. But after all, the story of Oedipus for him has psychoanalytic resonance. And Freud's student, Jones, actually talks about at length about Hamlet and how Hamlet himself would like to be Oedipus. But, right, and the reason Hamlet is so furious with Claudius is that Claudius killed Hamlet's father and married Hamlet's mother. In other words, Claudius did all the things that Hamlet wanted to do. Okay, now in that approach, in Ernest Jones's approach, you do a kind of psychoanalysis of a literary character. Sometimes, or more frequently, a psychoanalyst might talk about the author of the work. And when psychoanalysis moved into film studies, this same ambiguity that you find in Book 10 of the Republic expresses itself there too. Sometimes they're talking about the director, you know, let's psychoanalyze the director. Sometimes the natural object seems to be the characters in the film. In what's broadly referred to as Lacanian film theory, the emphasis came to be on the members of the audience and what a particular mode of editing or a kind of scene did to the psyche of the person in the audience. All I want to observe is that psychoanalysis, as it brought itself to film, repeated that ambiguity and that indecision that we find in the Republic when Plato brings his kind of psychoanalysis to bear on tragedy. So long answer to your question. I find it interesting that psychology seems like it ought to have something to say about art, and yet presents us with this difficulty. We're not sure how to go about applying it to art.
Yeah, and it's okay. So you bring up film, but obviously there's so many literary evidence even before film. I mean, I'm a big Russophile, so obviously Dostoevsky jumps to mind as somebody who's, I mean, a perfect example of trying to understand the human psyche in it. But I was going to say another point that I guess you have to worry when you have Sophocles or Euripides' work. I mean, Euripides is a weird guy, let's be honest. He's dark and twisted and takes perfectly normal stories and makes them even worse, or pretty bad stories and makes them really, really worse.
And yet, as Aristotle said, you can criticize Euripides all you want, but he was the most tragic of the poets. But
yeah, I mean, and it's interesting that he was less popular in his day and age for being so controversial. And yet I feel like he is translate better to modern era than, say, Aeschylus or something like that. Like that his stories are compelling in a way to us. But I was going to say the problem we have, though, with writers, playwrights, you know, artists that have been dead for so long, we can't ask them questions, is we do have the ability to misinterpret. And I like to think of, you know, Beckett's issue with Waiting for Godot. I mean, everybody said, oh, surely Godot is God. And he's like, no, it's not. Stop saying that. So if you don't have the artist to correct misinterpretation, then the art, I guess, takes a life of its own that really reflects the psychology of the modern audience rather than anything to do with the ancient stuff.
Ah, yes. And a lot of great things in what you just said. Incidentally, now I wonder if this, I have a colleague at the CUNY Graduate Center in theater, and he really works in a lot of non-Western theater, Japanese and other traditions. And one day we were talking about ancient tragedy, and he said, not by way of criticizing Aeschylus or Sophocles, but he said on the modern stage, Euripides is the first one you can actually stage. Just to his mind, the others just did not present in the same way as theatrical events, okay? Or not that he was, again, I make it sound as though to him, Sophocles and Aeschylus had not gotten the trick down yet. I think what he meant was a modern audience can see a play of Euripides and respond to it as a theatrical play less problematically than they can with Sophocles or Aeschylus.
Okay, well, I'm going to come to defense of Philoctetes because
what I would have expected. But
I was in college. I was the first play I directed for the Classic Society in Edinburgh. And it was funny because the same year, The Lord of the Rings came out. And so I kind of combined the idea of the precious, the ring, with Philoctetes' The Precious, the Bow. And that play is an entire, there's no blood, there's no violence. It's just basically three characters and three soldiers that just interact in trying to persuade somebody to do something they don't want to do, and somebody who's bitter and angry about it. It's just a complete delve into psychological conflict. Obviously, I have to justify it because it's my baby. So.
No, it's fascinating. Yeah. And he's right to be bitter and angry.
Yes, yeah. He was deserted on an island.
If I'm not mistaken, that's the earliest play in which a character draws our attention to the ambiguity in the word xenos, that it, you know, that it means both someone very different from you and potentially an enemy, but also it can mean someone you have a particular connection with and therefore kind of a friend.
Well, and it's great too, because Odysseus is horrible person in it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Not that he's not horrible other times.
Well, there must have been some other Odysseus traditions kicking around. And I believe those people who say that the Homeric poems exist to kind of eliminate rival traditions. And like, here's going to be the canonical story of Odysseus that you get to hear. You know, he went on one more adventure after he got home, and then nothing happened. So don't come to us, you know, from Corinth and saying, no, Odysseus slept here. He didn't sleep there. Okay. But in some of those rival traditions, he must have been even more unscrupulous. I mean, his grandfather Autolycus, right? The wolf itself, the one who we're told gives Odysseus his name, right? As like, what is this? Hateful, or someone who will be hated. He was apparently an unscrupulous character. And yeah, so Odysseus has that side this might be the only real remnant of that very mean side of Odysseus in classical literature, right? You mentioned the Circe novel, and she, obviously, Miller knows her stuff, and her depiction of Odysseus in his final day, I think, is really sensitive to this other side of the tradition and the really unlikable side of the man. Yeah. But okay. So you're gonna make your, you can defend the staging possibilities of Sophocles. And I love the precious bow. But I guess I'm still tempted to say that the psychology in Euripides is somehow more human psychology than mythological psychology. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I mean, like, the reality is that for most people reading Euripides, I mean, hopefully this is the reality, they're gonna have a much harder time relating to the characters because they're so extreme. I mean, there's not that many women who murder their children, fortunately. So that's going to be a hard thing for them to relate to. You know, that there's many times in that instance where he just takes it that extra step further. And I guess the question is that psychologically, what is the value about reading that stuff that is so horrible? You know, like, why do we want to read Dostoevsky? Why do we want to see infanticide and matricide and incest and all these horrible things? Like, what, I mean, I'm sure Plato would have plenty to say about that.
You shouldn't.
Stay away.
Stop that. Well, and yet, of course, we do. And look at one level. I'm not reducing all theatrical spectatorship to this phenomenon, just pointing out a point of similarity. I was walking home, and back in the days when, you know, people walked around, there had been work going on a scaffold on a very high building near the building I live in, and the scaffold had partly collapsed, so that the two or three workers who were on the scaffold were hanging on. By the time I got there, the fire department had been called, and, you know, fire departments know what to do about people, you know, just hanging out outside the window. It's obviously they've encountered this before. And there was a growing crowd of people staring. Now, it goes without saying that the people who were standing in the street staring were not going to help. You know, there's nothing they could have done to help. The fire department, I was very glad they were there and they were helping. And I thought, okay, they've taken care of it. I don't need to phone the fire department, you know, and I went home. But a lot of people wanted to watch. Why? They weren't watching so that they could go in there and help. There's something about a very dangerous situation unfolding in front of you that you are powerless to do anything about, right? So it's not as though you watch when you should be rushing in to help, right? Someone stumbles in the street and it's your responsibility to go help them across the street. You watch because you either, well, you could do nothing at all, but you don't do nothing at all. The temptation is almost overwhelming to watch this dangerous situation that you can't do anything about. Now, there's more to tragedy than that. Nevertheless, we are drawn in both cases to watch with fascination when someone's life might be at stake.
Well, I mean, we know that every single time there's a traffic jam because of a car accident and everybody's doing the rubbernecking. It's like watching a train wreck. I mean, it's literally embedded in our language as something that basically reveals that we're all morbid.
And tragedy takes advantage of that morbidity in our viewing habits. Absolutely. I do want to go back and just say, pick up on Sophocles 1 second, because I worry that I was put in the position of denying Sophocles his proper role. There's this one thing that happens in Sophocles, and it happens twice. Now, Sophocles, of course, is credited with having either brought the third actor into tragedy or really developed what the third actor could do. And in both the Electra and Oedipus the King, he has a type of scene in which a messenger comes and brings news to two people. And the two people are in different situations. They have different desires and sometimes different information. And they respond oppositely to the messenger. Okay, so for example, in the Electra, the tutor of Orestes in disguise comes and gives the news that Orestes has been killed in a chariot accident. He tells this to Clytemnestra and Electra. Clytemnestra, though mourning her son, is relieved that this one person she thought might kill her is now removed from danger. Electra, not only mourning her brother, is thinking the one person who could have brought justice to the home of Agamemnon is now not available. And it's one piece of news interpreted by the two other characters there in opposite ways. It's really a dramatic moment. And it's also the discovery by Sophocles of a remarkable dramatic technique. And it's the kind of thing you don't even notice when you read Electra, because we've seen that sort of thing. You know, how many plays like that have we seen by the time we finished high school, you know, where two people respond oppositely to the same piece of information? But it took Sophocles to figure out how to stage that for the first time.
It's like taking that internal conflict and making it representative to the group, you know.
Yeah. And there's another, by the way, there's another criticism that Plato has to make against tragedy. Not only does it appeal to the morbid side in us when we watch, but he says this not in any of his more famous criticisms of poetry, but kind of an aside in the Laws. It's this, that when you've got a really inspired playwright, says the Athenian stranger in the Laws, that this playwright creates characters who will talk on both sides of an issue. And the playwright never takes a stand, like it's this side or that side. Well, of course, to us, that's good drama, you know? You know, but to Plato, it says, what is this? You know, you're telling me it's good that Orestes was killed. You're telling me it's bad that Orestes was killed.
Yeah. Come on, that was Sophocles. Fine. Yeah.
What kind of a writer are you? Yeah, you're all over the place. That's right. Well, Plato would say the very idea of dramatic presentation goes against these habits you try to inculcate in children. Figure out what the truth of the situation is. Come up with a defense of it. Instead, they're saying, ah, you could say this, you could say that. Yeah.
So in keeping with sort of the theme of the Dionysus or the Linnea, the festivals where you have like four acts of theater and then you end with comedy, maybe I can bring up comedy as a little tip at the end. How did Plato feel about comedy then if he, you know, had so much to say about tragedy?
Yeah. Great question. Very few bits of evidence on which to base an answer.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't have quite the phenomenon with Plato that we do of Aristotle, where the book two of the Poetics on comedy was lost. From time to time, comedy does seem to be included in this general attack. So, for example, in book three of the Republic, when we're told that the young people should not perform roles that are undignified, a lot of the examples come from comedy. And you know, you think we've got undignified comedies. You know, there were really undignified characters in old comedy, the comedy that Plato grew up watching. In Plato's Philebus, he talks about the unhealthy emotions that come to light when we experience a comedy. And yet, he doesn't seem as worried about comedy as he does about tragedy. Now, the particular comic playwright that does get mentioned the most in Plato is Aristophanes. Of course, Plato's very aware that the play Clouds by Aristophanes had a lot to do with the general antipathy in the Athenian public towards Socrates. It seems as though no one had heard of Socrates. You know, Aristophanes' Clouds is the first literary mention of Socrates that survives. And it dates to 423 BC. Mm-hmm. Isn't it? Out of the blue, you go into the theater one day. Now, why would Aristophanes have written a play about someone that nobody knew? Well, you just have to speculate. It was right after a battle that we know Socrates was involved in. The story had it that the general was, you know, everyone was fleeing for their lives because Athens had to retreat, but Socrates walked with measured dignity. You know, maybe people noticed. I don't know if that's that doesn't make Aristophanes say, I want to write a comedy exposing this guy Socrates. I don't know. But the first that Athenians heard of him was that he, as you know, that he ran this thinkery. The Apology makes its anger with this representation of Socrates really pretty clear. You know, it's just a bunch of slanders thrown together. On the other hand, and this is something I wanted to say to you by way of your question. In Plato's Symposium, Aristophanes gets what most people would call the second best speech in the symposium about what Eros is. You know, it's a depraved view. It's a view that has to be refuted, no doubt. But it's an insightful and certainly memorable view. So there it seems as though Plato has some respect for Aristophanes. There's an ancient anecdote that says that Plato slept with the plays of Aristophanes under his pillow. I don't know if you could do that in those days. You know, if things were written on papyrus rolls, you know, I don't know. Make a lumpy sleep. And that's just an anecdote. Plato is also credited with a certain number of little epigrams, little, you know, one or two line poems. And one of them says, great, now that I've said that, I have to remember what it said. Something like, the graces seeking an imperishable sanctuary found their home in the soul of Aristophanes. I might be off one or two words, but the graces seeking a sanctuary and finding their home in Aristophanes are all in that. So somehow comedy is not as bad as tragedy. And now, if I had to speculate why it's not, I think Plato would say that comedy engages the critical intellect more than tragedy does.
Yeah, or maybe it was just his guilty pleasure. Maybe that was him trying to watch Thor in the middle of night, you know.
That's right. So if I were writing a critique of something and then you say a footnote saying, well, Thor is okay.
Yeah.
You know, you think, okay, what's Nick up to?
Everybody's got to be human in the end of the day, even Plato, right?
Everyone
needs to take a bit of a break.
And look. And now I'll just refer to this interpretive problem because people have approached it. No one's got a real answer for it. Aristophanes wrote this play, Women in the Assembly, that describes, seems to make fun of, but anyway, describes a utopia in which women vote. You know, women have the same rights as men. People share meals. And lawsuits have ended because, you know, the injustices that led people to sue one another are no longer present. Those are some of the features that we find in Plato's Republic as a description of the good city, although the Republic must have been written decades after the Aristophanes play. You can't help thinking Plato saw this comedy and thought, I could use these ideas. So he's not going to be just dismissive of Aristophanic comedy.
Yeah, and obviously to be comedic, I mean, takes a certain high level of intelligence and wit. And
that's right.
You think of, I don't know, Oscar Wilde or Dorothy Parker, even like more contemporary, I mean, contemporary for people like us, examples.
This last week for people like us.
Yeah. I blinked and that was them, yeah. I could see that you have to have a certain amount of respect for the amount of cleverness that's just involved. You know? But maybe just to kind of finalize up a little bit, I do really want to talk about Plato's Republic. Because you have written an excellent guidebook to Plato's Republic. So I'm going to ask you a really broad question, which might be totally unfair. But what would you say is the overall just goal of the Republic? Because you sort of cover the whole bit of it and you know so much about Plato.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your kind words. And it's funny you should also say that because recently for a couple of reference works, I was asked to write or update short entries on the Republic. And one of the things I'm grateful for in my line of work is I don't get tired of talking about Plato's Republic. You know, how lucky, you know, it can easily turn out that after 30 years writing about a single work, you know, it's the last thing you want to hear about. But I've been lucky. It was the Republic. You know, weirdly, I've never thought about answering that question before. And yet, also weirdly, I feel as though I know what to say about the overall goal of the Republic. One of the most famous bits in the Republic, I don't have to tell you this, I probably don't have to tell anyone, is the proposal of philosopher kings. That's how they're often referred to, although Socrates makes clear it's also philosopher queens. You know, so it's not just it's not just governance by men, but that philosophers should have the power heretofore possessed by kings and queens. Now, of course, that's a memorable feature of the Republic. But I think it brings us to the heart of the Republic because look, even if that's not the mode of government that you want, that we adopt, it reflects the big purpose of the dialogue, which is philosophy is a famously impractical subject. It's not as though the ancient Greeks thought philosophy was practical. They had jokes about philosophers falling down wells as early as there were philosophers. I mean, that story was told about Thales, who's referred to as the first philosopher. So as soon as there are philosophers, they're mocked for being impractical.
Thales made a lot of money, though, predicting a harvest. And he was also the first example of a short, right? By lending out presses, all of presses. So he proved people that they were wrong. Philosophy was smart.
But why? Why did he put deposits down on all of presses? Because everyone was telling this, you know, was saying that philosophers are impractical. He had something to prove. Like, see, I can use this brain power. Okay. But So here's philosophy, maybe the most famously impractical subject. And the Republic is asking, what can this famously impractical subject tell us about politics, which is all about being pragmatic and even about being cynical to the greatest degree? Sure, maybe philosophy can tell you about shoes, what kind of shoes people should wear, or what kind of food they should eat, or you know, what their family life should be like. But good Lord, you know, you're not going to have philosophy tell us about politics. And yet that's what the Republic sets out to do. Plato has written other dialogues that are about political reality, but no other dialogue that makes politics the domain of the philosopher. And so I do think that this proposal of governance by a philosopher, and I say this knowing it's an obvious thing to say, loving it because it's an obvious thing to say, because you have to. This proposal of governance by philosophers gets you to what the whole Republic is about, okay? You might grudgingly assign some role to philosophy, you know, within a culture, but the Republic is trying to answer cynicism. Now, I have to say a little bit more because to defend what I just said, simply because people often refer to the Republic as a utopia, or they describe it as utopian, you know. And I don't think it's a utopia. If it were a utopia, that's kind of not interesting. Say, what can philosophers say about a made-up society? Well, oh boy, you know, let's construct a fantasy world and let philosophers talk about it. Okay, but what actually happens in the Republic, as Socrates says, let's talk about a good city. He starts describing a utopia, you know, a rural hamlet, people work hard, you know, they rest, they're vegetarians, really nice people. Okay, that's the ideal city. The people that Socrates is talking to, you know, they've heard enough. this is like a town fit for pigs. I want a sophisticated city. And Socrates says, oh, you want to talk about the diseased city. I think it's clear he means Athens. And he sets about explaining how philosophy would turn not some little commune left alone into a just society, but how philosophy could turn an existing, compromised, complex society into a just society. That's the hard part. And so it's important to say that it's not a utopia, because it's how philosophy can enter life even when life is being its most cynical. So how's that for an overall goal for the Republic?
I like it. I like it. I'm impressed. That's a very concise answer for a really big book.
Now, you know, I have to tell you, I read The Republic in 1977, and I reread it since then. But of course, the frustration for me now is there's nothing else I know as well as I know that. I don't know if I'd have time to get to know a second work in the same way, but it's okay. I'll settle for that.
Well, Nick, I think I've got to say thank you so much for taking your time to talk with me today, because you have been very illuminating, both in the all of Plato's realms and art and literature. And it's been an absolute delight to learn a bit more about Plato and his work.
Well, Anya, I have to thank you for this opportunity. Great conversation. Now I have to watch or listen to all of the conversations you've held, because I can just imagine what you've brought out of all these other interlocutors you have. So thanks so much.